Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for September 8th, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with Nick Bowling and PJ Powers from Timeline Theater Company. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guests this week are from Timeline Theater. They're two of the co-founders, Artistic Director PJ Powers. Say hello, PJ.
Hello.
And the original Artistic Director, and now one of the company members and one of the premier directors in Chicago, Nick Bowling.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Hello, Nick. All right, PJ, let me start out with you. Tell us about the season. I know you've opened weekend, the Gore Vidal play, which I thought was just fantastic.
Oh, great. Thank you. Yeah, we just opened. It's a play that Gore Vidal wrote 40 years ago, and it had a very not illustrious run on Broadway, a very brief run in 1968. It was very much a current events play at the time, and it has really lived in obscurity for the last 40 years, and I found it in a library a couple of years ago and loved it and thought it was hilarious and very timely, and then did the research to find out that it really hadn't been done or touched in the last 40 years. And we thought that what's interesting about it, it kind of works, I imagine, better now as a history play than it probably did as a current events satire in 1968.
And people were too close to it, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they thought it was something like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Right.
Because it had an interracial theme, but it really isn't about that.
No, it really isn't about that. It's really Gore Vidal, as he's done throughout his entire career, poking fun at the political process and poking fun at the average citizen's role in the political process, and it's wickedly funny, and I've heard from people during the first couple weeks of the run, every night in our lobby, people comment that they can't believe this wasn't written a month ago.
Right. I had a young playwright friend of mine who's 25 years old, mm-hmm. came to it, and he was blown away. But now he's reading everything Gore Vidal.
There's a lot to read.
Yeah, and he's reading all the novels. But he said to me, did they update this?
Yeah.
Because of the references to Nixon and Reagan.
We didn't update a word of it. And so we're proud that we're finally giving due to this play that sadly has lived in obscurity for so long. And people are really having a great time at it. And, as the election season is now in its 10th month of full steam, I think people are finding a lot of enjoyment coming here. And, it's a smart night out of great comedy. And it's a well-made play in the way that just you don't see plays getting written nowadays.
Well, I told Terry Hamilton, I said, I saw his character, who's really the most evil guy in at the manipulative senator, I saw him as Bill Clinton.
Huh, interesting.
He kind of reminded me of Clinton.
Yeah, he's little pieces of many, many politicians. But there definitely is even though in the play he's a Republican senator, there definitely are some Clinton similarities there.
Well, all the maneuvering.
Folks,
this is one of the best plotted plays you'll see in a while. And you think it's going one way, and then it goes another way, but it doesn't fool you. The hints were there.
Yeah.
It's a smart piece.
Yeah.
How is it doing?
It's doing phenomenally. We just had Labor Day weekend, which you would imagine is a tough sell for theater.
Yeah.
A gorgeous weekend outside and many people's final weekend to be out doing stuff outdoors or with their family or before school starts. And it was packed. We had waiting lists this weekend. It was absolutely packed. It was great.
Wow, that's it. So now what else we have coming up? You get the next one,
and then
Nick's going to talk about the last two.
To Mr. Bowling. You know, it's tough to fight over this microphone. our next show, which is opening the very beginning of November, is a Chicago premiere of a play called A House with No Walls by Thomas Gibbons. And a couple other Gibbons plays have been done locally at Northlight, B. Luther Hatchie and Permanent Collection. And this play we're doing, House with No Walls, it was inspired by an event in Philadelphia a few years ago when they were going to be opening a Freedom Museum, a Liberty Museum, on the grounds of George Washington's house, grounds in which he also owned and housed slaves. And there was an outcry in the community in Philadelphia that how could you be opening this museum honoring freedom and liberty without acknowledging that there were slaves there. And so this play really examines that contemporary argument of should we be continuing to look to the past and dwelling on that, or is it time to turn the page and move past that. So the play examines that contemporary argument, and it also jumps back in time a couple hundred years and focuses on, in particular, one of Washington's slaves, Oney Judge, as she was trying to escape. And she, in real life, eventually did escape, actually.
Wow, this sounds interesting. I know Permanent Collection had dealt with a museum and some of those similar themes.
Well, you know what's fascinating? Thomas Gibbons, this is the third in sort of his trilogy on race with B. Luther Hatchie and Permanent Collection. And what's fascinating is Thomas Gibbons is a white playwright, and yet he's built his entire canon of three plays on the African-American experience in America in contemporary times,
which is amazing. Yes.
Which is fascinating. And he's based out of Philadelphia.
Well, that shows how we've grown in the art too, that we can now have quote unquote black or African-American plays that don't necessarily have to be written by African-American.
Well, and to be, you know, perfectly candid, we recognize that here at Timeline, in now we're just starting our 12th season, we've had far too few discussions in our building about race, on our stage, I mean, and with our audience. And
boy, again, your timing is so good with what may happen in the presidential election.
We weren't trying to be that sort of opportunistic. We really just felt that it was time to have a frank discussion about race. And ironically, as we were really nailing this play down, it was last March, around the time that Senator Obama made his major speech on race, ironically also in Philadelphia, where he made that. And I remember many of us commenting, wow, that's one of the most frank discussions we've heard in our adult lives about it. And it's high time that we have one of those frank discussions in our theater.
Well, kudos to you for that.
There's a lot to discuss with this play.
Wow.
It's a big, messy play with a lot of bold ideas.
And that opens November 1st.
November 1st, yes.
Okay, now we get
I'll finally
we
let
get
Mr.
my
Bowling,
director.
Let me pass off this microphone. I hope I get it back ever.
Give me that.
Okay, tell us what you have, because you're directing the next two plays.
I'm directing the third and the fourth play of the season. The third play is a world premiere of a play called Not an Affair, written by a playwright named Masha Oblensky. And I think it's one of Masha's first plays. First full-length plays, one of her first probably produced play. As a company, we're all drawn to this play. It really is about, in some ways, the creation of the play Machinal, which is Sophie Treadwell's 1928 expressionistic kind of shattering play that made Sophie Treadwell one of the most famous female playwrights of the early part of the 20th
brilliant
century.
Play, yes.
It's an amazing play, a play that I've always loved too, and I started loving that play in college when I was directing, and I've always wanted to direct that play. And actually, when we first started Timeline, it was a play that we very much talked about as a great Timeline type play. But this is a play about the creation of that play, but more than that, it's about Sophie Treadwell and about her fascination with these women that end up killing their husbands because they end up getting caught in this sort of machine of what a woman is supposed to do. And Sophie Treadwell was a woman that very much lived the opposite life of that. She lived by herself, even though she was married, and she was a very fairly powerful woman in that she had a job. She took care of herself. She kind of called the shots in her relationship in a lot of ways. And It's sort of a dance between those two plays, and it juxtaposes the two plays. It juxtaposes the two lives of these women, and it also examines, you know, those challenges for women in the 1920s, but also it explores those challenges of sort of submitting and how can you submit without giving yourself fully and still holding on to yourself in some way, and those sort of questions. It's really a lovely play.
Great.
Yeah.
And that's going to open, what, 24th of January?
Yes,
is the date
good.
I
Thank
see
you,
here.
Tom, because okay. I have no idea, really. I just know when I'm supposed to be in rehearsal.
See how smart I am when you guys make great,
no,
great
that's
press
good.
Packets?
Right. And then after that, of course, is the play that we're all very excited about, a very big deal for us to have gotten the rights to do the Chicago premiere of Alan Bennett's The History Boys.
Tell us how you got the rights to that.
Well, it was all me. It all really came down to my name.
BJ, you can jump in here. I
you know,
have a feeling you're involved.
There's Bob Falls. There's other directors in town, but then they heard Nick Bowling was around. They said, okay.
Time to hand over that microphone again.
I don't know that I have a big juicy story for you about how we got it. You know, I'd love to tell you that we got into this, you know, vicious bidding war, and we made what I think was a great proposal and made a great case that Timeline was the theater that would do the production that this play deserved for Chicago audiences.
After all, you do history plays, and you've got a big track record.
It's what we're about. And, you know, we made the case that we've premiered a lot of significant plays here. Tennessee Williams, Not About Nightingales. It was the first Midwest production right after it was newly found and done on Broadway. We did the Chicago premiere of Guantanamo. It's really a long list. So we made a great case that we would give it the stellar production that
so
it deserved.
So you put a proposal in sort of, I don't know what you do, bid on it or ask for it.
Yes, and they said yes. Here it is. We put it in your hands, and we're thrilled. We're absolutely thrilled. And I think even people who saw the play either in London or Broadway are going to experience something very, very different in our theater. I mean, obviously, just the intimacy of our theater, and with a different cast. You know, that original cast of History Boys, who now are so famous because they did the play for like 4 years in London, and then on Broadway, and then a world tour, and then back to London, and then doing a film of it. So I think a lot of people have those actors in their mind if they saw the production or saw the film. But you know, they're going to see a very different take on it here, and be, you know, a few feet away from the action as opposed to in a couple thousand seat Broadway house.
How do you, what's going to be your interpretation? Because I have not yet seen the film, but people have told me who have seen the film and saw stage production.
Yeah.
They didn't like the film. They thought the stage production
was so
much stronger.
It's very different. I mean, there's a good 45 minutes that's cut out in the film. You know, and inevitably you have to make allowances in doing a film. I think the film is fine for what it is. I think the play is superior. Maybe I will let Nick have the microphone
back.
Yeah,
we got to ask the director on what his vision
is. Well, I think one of the challenges with that film for me, and why I didn't see the stage production and I did see the film before I even knew I was going to be directing it. One of the challenges for me is there's something challenging about a film of the same actors that have been doing a play for 3 years or however many years they'd been doing it at that point. And then the changing of the medium into film, and it doesn't, for one thing, frankly, to me, the film doesn't feel very fresh, and the production should be very fresh.
Yeah. And that's what some of the real astute people have told me.
Yeah. And you know, so that's what I didn't like about the film. It felt slick to me, and it felt sort of, it just felt old hat in a way, and it's really important to this play that there's a kind of an excitement to it. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of newness to the things that happen in the play. There's a lot of you know, sort of virgin skin in this play.
Give us a little sense of what the play's about for our listeners
It's about so many things, but really it's set at a boys' preparatory school in England in the 80s, and the boys in question are all incredibly bright, middle-class boys that are all hoping to get into Cambridge or Oxford. And they've been taught by a kind of a wonderful old teacher named Hector, who has his own style of teaching, very unique style of teaching. And the fear from the headmaster of the school is that none of the boys will get into Oxbridge because either of these schools, because they haven't been able to get any boys in for the past year. So they bring in a kind of a young maverick teacher to help, you know, these boys think in a new way. And it is, and it's, and it, and so it's very much about that. But then it's also about it, there's a lot of sexual revelations and sort of a. It's very much about the old teacher versus the new, but also about discovering sexuality and about some people may say pedophilia, and it's about a lot of other crazy things. And it's a really beautiful, complicated play. And it, what's so lovely about it is it really is an intellectual person's dream, in that it's full of references to wonderful poets and to wonderful films and all things kind of historical and English.
So it's a thinking person.
It is.
Kind of,
and yet at the same time, it's this marvelous kind of really lovely coming of age story of young boys and learning and discovering and all those things as well. All right.
Hold on. And I mean, one of the things that attracted us to it is because in many ways, what Alan Bennett is getting at in the play is what we try and get at with all of our shows, now going on 37 shows. It's about, it really asks the question of why is there value in looking at history and what do we have to learn from it or gain from it? How can we be enriched by it or nourished by it or educated by it? And he brilliantly poses that question and also poses the question of looking at how anything is taught in the state of education. He really uses Thatcherite England, but it very much could be, 2008, No Child Left Behind America. Ugh. Of what,
yes.
What is the nature of education, and are we teaching these facts just so they can be spat back out and recited in a test, or is there learning for learning's sake, and particularly art and history. And what do you have to gain by studying that? And there's a clash in this play between the older teacher Hector and the young hotshot teacher Irwin, who have different points of view.
Wow, this
it's a powerhouse
play. You guys sound like you're just a tad excited about this.
A little bit, yeah.
What a coup for you guys! I mean, you would expect Steppenwolf, Goodman, well, maybe writers or Court to get this. But then you guys are right up there, so it's deserving.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about the step up you guys have made. You're now an equity theater.
We are now.
Tell us the thinking behind that.
An equity theater. Really one of the best things that having access to Equity Actors does is it just expands our casting pool that much more. It's always been critical to our work to have the best actors possible on our stage, and
well, you guys always had. I've always said that you guys, your casting is so good. Where you find these non-equity actors that are up on par with any of the equity actors is amazing.
Well, thank you.
Terry Hamiltons and yeah, David Parks, yeah, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But now with equity, that one role or that two roles, like I could see expanding the pool for History Boys.
Yeah.
Where you can now get some tops if you need it.
It does open up our casting pool in a new way, and we spend a lot of time on casting around here because it's really critical. Not only finding people that are wildly talented, but also people that you want to be in a room with for a few months working and
yeah,
going,
that's underrated,
going to
isn't it?
It's really underrated, yeah. And it's it can't be undervalued. Because talent is one thing, and a lot of people have it, but finding chemistry and enjoyment on stage for 9 weeks during a run is something that you can't fabricate.
So it's a balance between talent and. But you guys are loyal to a lot of your ensemble.
We do have a number of actors that have worked here a lot, and it's obviously always important to us to give them opportunities, and but it's equally important to us to find that emerging talent in town, and we spend a lot of time looking for new talent in town, and you know, in the History Boys, I anticipate, I don't have anything to announce yet, but I anticipate you'll be seeing a lot of people, just the nature that there are a lot of
young people. Yeah, I heard you've already been auditioning for that. I mean,
it's
that
in
far
the works.
In advance. Well,
yeah.
That's terrific.
It's in the works, yeah.
Well, that's a good way to nail down some of the best talent, too, if
yeah,
you can commit to them that
you
early.
You got to book people early, yeah. the best people, that's true.
Well, Nick, I have to congratulate both of you guys on one of the most successful shows in your history, Fiorello.
Thank you.
What a stage that! I understand as many of these dramatic plays that you've done, that you, a big part of you is about musicals.
It is. My undergraduate degree is in musical theater. My whole childhood was, you know, sort of about musical theater. So when the truth is, I was about musicals until I worked at the Court Theater for 4 years with Charlie Newell. And it was not until I got to the Court that I kind of realized, oh God, it'd be fun to direct straight plays too, and not just musicals. And that was honestly, and actually when I went to school at DePaul and got my master's degree, and I directed all straight plays there too. And so those two experiences really kind of opened my eyes to other things. But, musicals is where that's what I really love to do. I really love directing musicals. And so we're going to try to do some more in the future.
But what a choice with Fiorello.
Thanks.
Now, two extremely successful productions of it.
Thank you.
And I
yeah.
remember, PJ, you were telling me that if you'd had another space, it'd still be going.
yeah.
Now and forever. Fiorello.
But, you know, that was such a neglected play. I mean, Marriott, Drury Lane, nobody.
Right.
Nobody touched that play.
Right.
And I was lucky enough to have seen it with Tom Bosley.
Right.
I was like 15 years old, and it really made an impression because here's this idealistic guy.
Yeah.
You know, and musically it was so clever.
It's musically spectacular. And, you know, the truth is, at first glance, probably people read that book, and there's a couple little references that I suspect make people a little afraid of that musical. It's written in 1959, and Sheldon would be the first, Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics and probably helped a lot with the book. He would be probably the first one to say, oh, there was a couple little things there that were a little dated or that were a little kind of old-fashioned about it. But really, and Sheldon was willing to sort of, you know, tweak those or play with some of those things. And he, in particular, there was a line, and there's a very famous line in I Shall Marry the Very Next Man Who Asked Me, that, have you ever heard about that line that got cut, that Sheldon
no.
cut? I'll just tell you the line really quickly, because it gives you an idea that maybe some of the reasons people stayed away from this musical. The character Marie is, you know, is so upset that Fiorello does not love her that she sings this line, this song called I Shall Marry the Next Man Who Asked Me. And she says, and if he strikes me, who cares? And if he likes me, who cares how frequently he strikes me?
Ooh.
I'll fetch his slippers with my arm in a sling just for the privilege of wearing his ring, which I think is kind of a gut-wrenching line, especially if it's in a kind of a ironic way. But Sheldon said that whenever that line was sung in front of women, that they booed in the audience.
Wow.
And
I can see why.
Yeah, right. It's a very dangerous
yeah.
kind of line. And and Barbara Cook apparently was the one who originally called him and said, Sheldon, you've got to change this line. I love the song, but change the line. And he did for her, and he did for subsequent parts of the production. But regardless, it's a beautiful play. It's a lovely, charming, wonderful play, and we had a great time doing it both times.
Well, tell us now how you got PJ to play it, because I know PJ had not done a musical.
So we auditioned.
Up till then.
That's not true.
No? Okay.
Young PJ Powers.
It
was
been 16 years.
Young,
okay.
I've seen pictures of PJ in spandex and jazz hands back in the peanut butter players days. Maybe he'll tell you about that. Anyway.
We'll let that slide.
Yeah. Anyway, you can look it up on the internet. But we did all these auditions for Fiorello's, and to be honest with you, from the very beginning, I said to PJ, I think you should play this role. And he said, seriously, I do not think I should be doing a musical. I don't want to do a musical. I'm not 5 foot you know, to Italian Jewish guy. I'm not that guy. And I said, but, you know, ultimately, it's not that important to me that he's 5'2" Italian Jew guy, even though that's who he was. It's more important that we find that kind of personality and that style. And really, in every way, PJ is like Fiorello in the best ways and in the most annoying ways. He's like Fiorello LaGuardia in that he's pushy and he gets blinders on at times and he drives things forward and he makes things happen. And that so much reminds me of Fiorello. And so from the beginning, I said, you're the right person for this role. And he doesn't have to sing well. It doesn't matter if you come out there. And we heard all these guys and they came in and they were like, the name's LaGuardia. And it was like, oh God, this is awful. If they sing that, it's awful if they sort of sing that like an opera singer. And so I, you know, finally convinced Mr. Powers to, you know, put on the big hat and play the role. And really, he was brilliant in the role and really drove the whole production in the way that he drives Timeline, too. So,
and I couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
So how frightening must it have been on the first time? The first preview, the first audience.
Unbelievably frightening. I really haven't experienced that type.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't experienced that type of anxiety in a long, long time. Really, I think what was more frightening was just beginning rehearsals. By the time I got to opening, I had gained a little bit of confidence. But going into rehearsal with 15 other actors who were all musical theater people and were extremely accomplished and were great... that was intimidating. But there was something kind of thrilling about being intimidated in a rehearsal room.
It's
even
a
though it was a theater,
you know?
That I was artistic director of, and you know had been a part of starting 10 years prior, and being scared in the rehearsal room in my own theater was probably a great thing to go through.
Just so our audience knows.
Yeah.
The PJ is not only artistic director, but he's one of the most accomplished actors around, including winning a Jeff Award for
Hauptmann.
Yeah.
Doing Fiorello, I will never live this down, unfortunately, with Nick, but it ended up being the best experience I've had, and I'm grateful that I got to do it.
I told you so.
Well, you know the testimony
how hard that is to put that on audio.
Okay.
Forever. Now and forever.
Good. Good thing these things are digital, right?
Yeah.
They can last.
I think I can safely say that I'm hanging up my musical theater shoes
until
the foreseeable future.
See.
Until we do the Music Man.
Yeah. Well, you know, you guys ought to really consider doing a musical a year if you can. I mean, there's enough your mission the history
we'll
type
do more.
Stuff.
I mean, one thing that was just so exciting for us to experience, and I think it's one of the reasons why people responded to Fiorello, is that in our intimate setting with amazingly brilliant acoustics in this 100-year-old building.
Yeah, the acoustics were very
and
good.
And you don't hear many musicals, even in small spaces in Chicago, which it makes me crazy, where everyone isn't mic'd. And
my pet peeve, I'm with you. And then even if they are, or if they're not, they mumble and you can't hear them.
Yeah, and it just gives sort of a tinny sound. And we did this musical with 16 actors, not a single microphone in the building, a 4-piece band, not a single mic on the band. And, you know, we were fortunate. It kind of was a perfect sound mix. But it was something that I think was thrilling for audiences to hear that sort of pure sound and power of this ensemble.
That was one of the first comments everybody made that we're possible. But you had veteran actors who know how to project.
Yeah.
And Nick, I'm sure you saw that in rehearsals. So many of the young singers come out today, they expect to be mic'd.
Well, yeah,
and
they,
you can't hear them.
They're used to only having to project to their forehead where they have a microphone taped or, you know, to their lapel. And that's just the nature of it. And the majority of the places that they're working, they only need to do that.
Well, I blame the directors who should be sitting in all the seats saying, you know, it's great, but I can't hear. You're dropping the last line of the song.
Yes. Welcome to the land of Nick Bowling.
Yeah. Are we on the same page there, Nick?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, it's interesting, Tom, that it really does come down to the space and the musical and the, you know, and there are some amazing performers in town who are those smaller voices, and some of them who I adore and would love to work with. And you know, we're lucky. I'd say we're lucky being able to do this show at this theater, and they it was a nice blend of something that worked really well together.
But you had strong voices.
Oh, very strong voices. I mean, and I, you know, I mean, we really, there were a few people that we talked about casting that we said, you know, ultimately they're not the right voice for this show because they don't have the power to, you know, sing over this orchestra as it.
Plus
as
the harmonies when you hear those.
Yeah, those guys, right.
The terrific songs.
Yeah, right. And the full chorus too, right. There, it was, you know, both times, and I'd say both times we had, I would say the second time we had half of the cast was back and half was new. And there were wonderful changes and wonderful things that I missed and things that I loved.
It was actually better. It was to take, you know, a show that was as good and flawless as, and yeah, to move it to another level. Everyone thought the remount was actually stronger.
Well, it's lovely to hear that. And in some ways, it always makes me worried about that original cast, too. There are so many of them that I just adored and who I think gave wonderful performances as well. For me, it was more the second time around, we really tried to bump up the world around them and try to define the production a little bit more. And I would agree that we got some great people. Some of them I think were very different than the first ones and maybe similar or not. But I'm happy to hear that people felt it was even better the second time around.
Yes.
And it's a lovely compliment. And I think the first time around was spectacular too. There were some lovely people, Cassie and Bethany, and some great people
yes.
in the first group too.
Okay. In the interest of time though, because the time is running out.
Right.
Tell us, Nick, you go first. Tell us what the future lies for you guys and for you personally and for timeline.
World domination is my plan. you know, we are in our 12th year right now. Is that right? I think what the future holds for us is, you know, one dream that we have, and it goes against something we just talked about, our wonderful space that we have here on Wellington. But we dream of having a bigger space someday because we're getting to the point where we're beginning to you know, overflow here in so many ways, and this building is amazing, and it's our second home. PJ's probably here more than he is actually at home, but along with the 100-year-old building comes 101 problems of heating and handicap accessibility. We had a woman here this weekend who was so angry that we don't have handicap accessibility. And I said, but the building's 100 years old. Do you know what it would cost us to do that? And it's really challenging. That's something, it's a dream for us. It means not just a bigger, newer, prettier space, but it means people coming to Timeline that may not be able to come right now. More people coming and seeing Timeline.
I agree.
That's our hope. One of our hopes.
PJ, what do you see as artistic director?
We've always aspired to grow and become one of the major players in town and to make a
where you are now.
And to make an imprint on a national scene and to build an organization that's larger than just the sum of its parts and then larger than just us and something that really plays a role in this vibrant arts community. I mean, it's one of the things that 12 years ago when Nick was first conning me into getting into this crazy endeavor, it's one of the things that hooked me. He talked about building something that was bigger than ourselves and bigger than just an individual career or, you know, mm-hmm. and building a legacy that we could share. And
well, you're sure on the way.
Well, thank you.
Need to find a bank like Porchlight did.
A bank filled with money or an empty one?
Well,
both.
Yeah, either way. But I mean, there's facilities around. I'm sure you guys are looking. I'd love to see you guys in something about the size that of like Victory Gardens.
Yeah, it's a beautiful new space.
About 300 seats.
Yeah, it's beautiful new space. Yeah.
Well, they're around, you know.
They are. They are.
And
call
you just,
me.
You just keep
if
up.
If you've got one.
Well, if we see one. If you... you're well known, you're winning awards, and I can see that you're on a lot of the grant lists. So I have a feeling that if a space came in, that you guys are strong enough where some of the serious money in town would probably help you guys out.
I hope so.
I think you're onto that level. Well, congratulations on what a great year you guys have and what a year you got. I can't wait for all the shows, but particularly History Boys.
Good, good. Yeah. You know, all four of our shows this season are all new to Chicago audiences. We're really thrilled with the lineup. I have to say, I know this probably sounds very sales pitchy, but I don't think we've had as solid a season as this, top to bottom, with all four of these shows. So we're thrilled.
Well, if you're up on that, my last question is, what's the process for picking these shows? Is it a committee? Do you pick them?
Or? No, I do not pick them alone. We have a company. There are eight of us in the company, and including myself, including Nick, and it's a very democratic process. You know, as artistic director, it's my role to lead that process and to, you know, push projects that I think we should be doing. But I have one vote of eight, and if I love a project and the other seven don't, you ain't seeing that project on our stage. And everyone has the ability to push and promote a project. You know, just speaking a few minutes ago about Fiorello, that was one that Nick felt very passionate about and really had to woo and lobby the other company members to get behind it. And obviously now he's saying, I told you so to all of them as well.
That's true to your mission, though, in terms of, you know, the history and the democracy.
But it's a great system of checks and balances, and we all have built up so much trust through the years. You know, some of these people I've been working with now for 14, 15 years, including Nick. And we really ask each other the tough questions that sometimes we don't want to be asked of. Why do we really need to do this play, and what new ground?
But that
are we
honesty leads
breaking?
To
absolutely
leads to good choices.
Exactly,
yeah. And so it isn't vanity. There's a big role for you, or
right?
Something
and else. even you know, post haste, we question ourselves of okay, what did we do well? What didn't we do well? And how can we learn from that experience and change things?
Wow.
So it's a great team that I wouldn't trade in for anything.
Well, folks, get over to Timeline Theater. And get to their website or click on our theater in Chicago, and we have all the listings for it, because whatever play they do, just go there. You're one of the few theaters that I recommend people just go there and don't worry about what the play is, because you're going to see a terrific show.
Well, thank you.
You guys you're at that level and have been for years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Tom. We appreciate it.
Folks, remember, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of September 8th, 2008. Broadway in Chicago has announced the national tour of Rent, starring original Broadway cast members Adam Pascal and Anthony Rapp. Rent will play a limited engagement at Chicago's Ford Center for the Performing Arts next March 31st through April 12th. Adam Pascal and Anthony Rapp originated the roles of Roger and Mark on Broadway and also recreated their roles in the 2005 movie version of the musical. Tours of Rent have crisscrossed North America almost continuously since 1996, grossing over $330 million. Rent opened on the Great White Way back in April 29th of 1996. The musical went on to win every major Best Musical Award, including the Tony Award and the Pulitzer Prize. It is the seventh longest-running show in Broadway history. Individual tickets will be available to the general public at a later date for this special Chicago engagement. Stay tuned to this podcast for the announcement. The Tribune is reporting that after 15 years of serving up original Chicago theater, the Bailiwick Art Center will be closing their doors sometime this fall. A newer theater company, Theater Wit, has reportedly signed a 10-year lease on the building and is planning to invest over $500,000 to renovate the Bailiwick's large stage into three separate spaces when it reopens next fall. No worries, however. David Zack and the Bailiwick Repertory Theater will continue producing at the center on Halsted Street. And their final in-house show will be The Christmas Schooner, the most successful show in Bailiwick's history. Be sure to click on over to Theater in Chicago's news section and check out another new article from Joe Stead. This one's about the Attic Playhouse. Joe interviewed artistic director Kimberly Laughlin about the company's 11th season. Catch the details for their upcoming production of Cold Cold Feet by Tony Fiorentino that opens this September 12th. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Nick Bowling and PJ Powers for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.